ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, and for the next hour, you're in Finland. Today is Monday, November 24th, and a lot happened on this day. It was on this day in 1995 that Ireland voted to approve a constitutional amendment legalizing divorce. There was no divorce in Ireland until 13 years ago. And, of course, there were a lot of angry married people. And they dealt with that. It was also the day that the Congress gave the final approval to the Brady handgun legislation, 1993. And, of course, Tom Brady, the quarterback, was in favor of handgun. No, this was Jim Brady, Ronald Reagan's press secretary, who was shot when Reagan was shot, but injured in the head and paralyzed, essentially. And it was through the force of his injury that the country came to grips with handgun control in cities. And it was on this date that The Pearl, John Steinbeck's novel The Pearl, was published for the first time. Now, I want you to think about what year that might have been, The Pearl. If you're a Steinbeck fan at all, and you might not be, and I understand that this literary stuff might be just a little too much for people, but it was 1947, right before I was born. In any case, as I said, today's the 24th, and boy, is there a lot of recent things in the news. So, as we look ahead to the Obama inauguration, the Washington Post, of course, we're local here, so we've seen a lot of interesting stories about this. But the Washington Post has talked about a couple of things. One is that they are thinking, the park police think there may be as many as 3 to 4 million people on the mall. Now, the National Mall has never been full before. Even the Million Man March, which is a big controversy about how many people it drew, some people say 600,000, 800,000, 400,000. But the park police stopped counting. They used to estimate crowds. And when the organizers of the Million Man March took offense at the estimate number and claimed they were being undercounted and discriminated against, the park police said, you know something? We're going to wash our hands of this. We don't really need to do these estimates. And if they're going to cause problems, if it's going to be a political issue, we don't need to do it. And what they do, and there are other people that estimate, you take pictures from the air and you estimate in each sector, each quadrant, each little square that you measure, you estimate how many people are there. So it's easily done, although there's a lot of trees on the National Mall, and in the heat of summer, you can't tell for sure how many people are clustered under trees. In any case, the mall was nowhere near full for that, for Martin Luther King's speech, for any demonstrations we've had on the mall, because the mall is huge. If you've ever walked it, you know it's not only fairly wide, it's extremely long. But they're talking about it being full and having 3 to 4 million people on the mall or in the area of the mall at the time of the inauguration. Of course, most of them won't see a dang thing, but it's amazing they're talking about that. And, you know, they're going to bring people in one train at a time during the course of the day before, the evening and all that, and people will come out of their hotel rooms and their rented townhouses and all. But when it's all over, everyone's going to be wanting to get on that first train out. And so I'm thinking that I'm probably not going down. I'm still toying with the idea. I love being part of a big crowd, and it would be a historic event, et cetera. But, man, 3 to 4 million people, can you imagine trying to find a restroom or something to eat? I think it'd be pretty bad. So I'm going to wait and see the weather. And if it's 45 to 55 degrees, I might go down. If it's 18 degrees, probably not. The second thing that was in the Washington Post, a couple of articles over the last week, is the issue of people trying to rent their places. So if you were to own a townhouse down near Capitol Hill, it is primo real estate, and people have want to rent those at exorbitant prices for the week of the inauguration. And so even if you live out in Virginia like I do, and I'm, you know, 30 minutes by car outside of D.C., 45 by the time you drive to a train station and take a train. Nevertheless, I've been told that my place is worth a lot of money if I wanted to rent it out that week. So the Post has had articles with stories about how you go about doing this, what to watch for, and also some sad stories. There were some Obama fans who were so confident he would win, they lined up a place to stay back in June or July, maybe May. And now that Obama has won and this real estate is so much more valuable, the rental agency that signed with them has canceled the contract, and apparently they're allowed to do that. So I thought that was interesting. Let's see. Also, there was a piece in the paper about cell phone thieves and how stupid they are, because what they do is they steal your cell phone and then they take pictures of themselves on it. And of course, those can be sent to people. You can download your settings from your cell phone when you get a new cell phone on certain kinds of phones, and those pictures download with it. And so this one thief got caught because he took a picture of himself on the stolen cell phone, and then the person downloaded all their settings and content and got his picture. They posted it on a police bulletin board, and he was caught. So another in the annals of stupid thieves. And this week we had the, well, really it was last week, we had the spectacle of the big three automakers showing up in front of Congress, hat in hand, but not much else. So they came to Congress and said, we need $25 billion to be bailed out or we'll go under. Please help us. And they said, well, what is your plan? What are you going to change? And they said, oh, trust us, we're going to retool. And they made the mistake of all flying in on private corporate jets, all on different private corporate jets. And when asked about it, you know, would you consider selling your jets or something, none of them had a word to say. They were silent. Now, since then, it's come out in the papers that Ford has announced it's going to sell two of its five corporate jets. GM had already announced that it was selling two, and they were already announcing they were selling two more, so now they're carrying through on that. Now, if that was true, they were already announcing they were going to sell four of their seven private jets, you wonder why the CEO of GM didn't speak up at the hearings, at the congressional hearings last week. But he did not. So they got it was bad PR because they came into town without a plan for how they were going to fix this. I mean, the country is not going to hand them $25 billion just to burn through it, right? These are the same leaders of these companies that got the companies in trouble, that have them in the predicament they're in now. Right? Now, what's interesting, of course, when we talk about 20%ers, the far right and the far left, they blame different sides. The far left is always going to blame management, and the far right is always going to blame unions. There's an unfortunate error going on around there, and it's been promulgated by several people in the media. I don't need to play the clips of it, but what they're basically saying is that the reason GM can't compete is because of unions, and that the unions are costing, union employees are getting $70 an hour in wages and benefits. And that because Toyota only pays 28 or 25 to 28, whatever it is, that they're cleaning their clocks. That is misinformation, by the way, if you've seen this number. And it's been said by reputable people. And we're not just talking the hacks on Fox News. We are talking about reporters who have gotten this misinformation. Basically, the labor costs with unions are roughly 28 to 35, a few dollars more, but not a lot more. The $70 number comes from a strange place. If you add up all the costs that GM has for labor and for benefits and for the benefits of their retirees, they are heavily in debt, because in the past, when unions wanted concessions, it was easier to promise them pension money, money in the future, than give them money now. So that's what they did. Management took the easy road out, much the way Major League Sports management takes the easy road out. And then they complain and say, oh, we can't make our payroll. But in fact, the $70 an hour figure is how much, if you take all the costs they have and spread them over the number of hours worked, it comes out to $70 an hour. But the employees that are working don't take home $70 an hour in benefits and salary. And I don't mean take home pay. I just mean they don't get that. They get less than half of that, or roughly half of that. So a little misinformation out there. But the far right is saying, oh, it's the unions that are driving the automakers under. And, of course, they are right, and both sides are right when they say that this is about the unions. Now, the Democrats are not claiming that this is about unions, but, in fact, they're trying to bail out the auto industry is about unions. Yes, they want to save jobs, but the Republicans in general and conservatives in general are saying, look, let them fail. There's no problem. You go into bankruptcy. That forces you to restructure. It forces you to get lean and mean. And you won't have to worry about whether the CEOs have a real plan or not. They will have to have a real plan if they go into bankruptcy. Here's the problem with that. From the Democrats' point of view, from the point of view of people who support union workers, what will happen if they go into bankruptcy is they will shed their pension responsibilities. Right now, they have promised lifelong pensions to all these retirees. And they should have been setting aside money for it all along, and it should have been growing, and et cetera, et cetera. But chances are they haven't covered that, so they have all these uncovered obligations, unfunded liabilities. Now, here's the reason why, just because Republicans say let them fail, let the unions take it on the chin, let the individual laborers take it on the chin, in general, Republicans and conservatives are okay with that because they're against unions. They like to say they're on the side of the average Joe. And, of course, the famous Reagan Democrats that everyone vies for in every election cycle, we're talking mostly union-type guys, if not union people. So the problem with letting GM fail and restructuring it under bankruptcy is that they will shed those pension responsibilities, but then they go over to a U.S. government agency that has to pick up the tab. The insurance, the pension insurance fund, or whatever it's called exactly, has to pick up these pensions then if they default. So bottom line, the taxpayer is going to get stuck with that bill. And so what the Democrats are saying and liberals are saying is don't make it come to that. We're going to have to eat the funds anyway. We're going to have to pay the bill anyway. Why not keep it from going into bankruptcy? And they argue there's one other thing going on here, and that is this. That if, TWA or Braniff goes into bankruptcy, you might still buy a ticket. If you're going to fly in 3 weeks, you might buy a ticket and then take a chance you're going to fly because it's only a couple hundred dollars, and you're only trusting that Braniff will be around for another 3 weeks. So if they fold, it doesn't cost you that much, and you're not counting on them being around for years and years and years. But when you buy a vehicle, you are, in fact, making the case that you will be out there, that you will have a relationship with this vendor for years, at least 3 years, probably 5 to 8 years or more. And so most people are not going to buy a car, is the argument, a GM product or a Ford product, if they go into bankruptcy. So sales will dry up. And that's the reason they're saying bankruptcy, particularly in these tight times, bankruptcy would be seen differently, and that you can't let the auto industry fail. The other piece of this, of course, is that 13% of the American economy is tied to the auto industry in some way. The vendors that supply parts and labor and the restaurants and stores and everything else that feed off of all that labor, all of that gets harmed if the auto industry goes in the tank. And they argue it's an issue of national security, that we should continue to make cars. And, you know, they're right in this regard. If we went to war the way we did in World War II, a big war where we needed to ramp up manufacturing, if you've got an auto industry, you've got people who understand manufacturing and robotics and all of this, you can retool in fairly short order and start producing other things like weapons and tanks. But if you don't have an auto industry, if we kind of give that up, yes, Toyota will still be making cars in Tennessee and Kentucky and Georgia and other places. But do we want to count on Toyota to be the backbone of our military industrial building machine if we're involved in a long-term or large-scale war where we need to gear up to create a lot of weaponry. And I'm just putting that out there. I don't know for sure what the answer is. In any case, we're going to take a break here on the Andy Finn Show on WEBR Radio, and we'll be back in $1 million. Hi, I'm Andy Finn. You know, even if someone handed me $1 million this morning, I'd still be doing my radio show on WEBR. Why? Because I have commitment. I have dedication. Plus, I signed a contract. Now, if you'll do the same, I'll have one more dedicated listener. Don't worry, you can void your contract if I ever get obsessed with liberals or gays, the flag, the pledge, embryonic stem cells, the UN, illegal immigrants, missing white women, or the country of France. So tune in the Andy Finn Show on WEBR, Mondays at 10 p.m. Hey, if you had $1 million, you could buy a radio station.
Well, that's certainly true. You could buy a radio station, at least a small one.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show on WEBR Radio here in Fairfax, Virginia, just slightly outside of the Beltway. And a little bit moving back to the Obama transition team, Obama not only met with Hillary Clinton and offered her the Secretary of State job, and that soap opera has been going on for 2 weeks, but apparently she is going to accept it right after Thanksgiving, and everything will be copacetic there. Obama sat down with John McCain last week, and they vowed to work together. I don't want to make a lot out of that, except he is reaching out. He's not only reaching out to McCain, he's reaching out to Lieberman. Now, you may have heard this whole story, but I knew they were going to settle with Lieberman because Obama said, let's play nice with Lieberman, and let's keep him in the fold. Let's keep him in the Democratic caucus. Let's not have revenge. And so when the Democrats sat down, they voted to allow Lieberman to keep his primary chairmanship. Now, they stripped him of some minor chair subcommittee, but he didn't really care about that. And he even said, this is not a punishment as far as I'm concerned. What they did was what they didn't do away with was his chairmanship of the Homeland Security Committee, which is a big, important department or committee. You may remember I came on the show last week and said that he should be stripped of this. I worry about what Lieberman might do. He is not a faithful Democrat anymore. He's broken with Obama and with the Democrats. Now, perhaps he'll be properly chastened, and he will now start siding with Democrats and with Obama, but basically he's this hawk on the Middle East, where it's time to try something besides hawkish behavior, and so he could easily get in the way. And once he does something as chairman of this committee, like holds hearings that the Democrats don't like, you can't fire him then. So that was my argument last week, and I still think it would have been not just prudent to penalize him and take that committee away, it would have been fun because, you know, it's retribution. And you shouldn't let it be known. I mean, this is the Republican point of view, right? You have to be tough. You have to show people you can be tough or they'll walk all over you. I mean, that's the whole basis for the Bush-Cheney foreign policy and for most Republican and conservative view of foreign policy. Their need to spend a lot on defense. Their need to show the world that we're tough. And so anything Obama does that's not, quote, tough enough, he'll be criticized for. And I want you to remember something. Do you remember George Bush's first foreign crisis? It wasn't 9/11. A Chinese fighter plane bumped a U.S. reconnaissance plane just outside of Chinese airspace right after Bush got in office, well before 9/11. And when he bumped the plane,
it destroyed the fighter plane and the pilot lost his life, and it harmed, it damaged the reconnaissance plane that the U.S. was losing and forced it to land on a Chinese island in the South Pacific. And the Chinese were insistent on embarrassing the United States, and so they first off put out that we bumped them. Of course, a reconnaissance plane cannot bump a fighter plane that doesn't want to be bumped. Secondly, so they blamed us for the death of their pilot. Secondly, they said it was our fault. And secondly, they refused to let us fly it off of that island. They made us dismantle it and put it in the cargo bay of a C-130 and take it home that way, as opposed to flying it out of there, just to embarrass or humiliate us. Now, I was actually reasonably proud of the way George W. Bush handled it. The Bush administration decided not to make an issue of it. They let China get away with this little PR move. Behind the scenes, I don't know what was said. I hope they gave him a good talking to. But at the time, my attitude was, you know, I'm not sure we should live with this. You know, I think we ought to call the Chinese out and at least say that they're lying when they say that we bumped them. But the Bush administration chose to handle it with kid gloves, let China have a wide berth and have their way and win that PR battle. I didn't hear Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, none of the holy BS crowd, Hannity, O'Reilly, Limbaugh, Ingram, Holy, and BS, Bortz, and Savage. I didn't hear any of those right-wing talk show hosts complain that George W. Bush was being soft on one of our adversaries. They gave him a pass. Do you think they'll do the same for Obama? I don't think so. The first time he shows any sign of compromising, they'll claim it's weakness. Mark my words, it's coming. So back to Lieberman, Obama showed weakness, is what the Republicans would say by their standards. They wouldn't put up with this. But Obama's being magnanimous. He's also being a smart politician. A, he gets an extra vote in the Democratic caucus, and he's closing in on 60 votes. He'll end up with 59, the way it's looking. If Al Franken can win his election, if he can steal his election, as Republicans like to claim he's doing, well, they'd have 59 votes. So we'll see. But Obama's being smart about that. He's also being savvy because Lieberman now owes him. You know, he campaigned for Lieberman when Lieberman asked him to in 2006, when a lot of Democrats were disowning Lieberman. And Obama went to Connecticut and campaigned for him, did him a big favor. And then Lieberman turned on him, not just supported McCain, he spoke at the Republican National Committee, and he said very negative things about Barack Obama. Called him a nice young man. Do you know what would happen if anybody on the Democratic side had called McCain an old man, but it was okay to call Obama a young man? No. A young man are the students I have in my classes, 18 years old. Obama's 47. The idea that somehow, you know, he's a young man. But that was the kind of rhetoric that was used. And harsher than that, saying he wasn't ready to lead, all that stuff. And Lieberman was part of all that. So Obama, in his magnanimity, has agreed to let Lieberman keep his committee post. And so we move on. Obama also made a few cabinet appointments this week. He nominated Tom Daschle, former senator and Senate Majority Leader, as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, HHS. That is a big department, and it looks like Obama's going to tackle health care right out of the gate, despite the financial concerns, because Daschle he's just written a book about health care, but he is on top of the health care stuff. Kennedy has also announced he will bring forth a health care bill, and he's planning to lead the charge. He offered Hillary a piece of the health care thing, but he also signaled her that this is going to be his baby. She doesn't have the seniority to push, to claim that it's her bill. and to be in charge of health care. So that's, I think, another reason why she's going to take the job in the State Department. And I guess while we're there, it's worth saying a minute, talking just a minute about Hillary and the State Department job. You know, it's funny how the drama of the Clintons is played out. The media is consistent that she will be a rogue agent and she might try her own foreign policy and all this. You know, there's almost no one else in politics they would say this about. Now, I know the Clintons have proven themselves to have big egos, right? But I don't think anybody takes a job as Secretary of State with any the intention of doing anything but carrying out that president's foreign policy. And I think it's just it's terribly juvenile of the media to be out there speculating that what Hillary's going to do. Will she be, you know, faithful to Barack? If she's not carrying out his policy, she'll be gone. It's that simple. They also chose the economic team, and that just happened today. So Larry Summers, as expected, has been made director of the Council of Economic Advisors, technically the National Economic Council. And that is a powerful position because he's close to Obama. He won't have the high profile of the Treasury Secretary, and that will be Timothy Geithner, who's chairman of the New York Federal Reserve Bank now. Now, Geithner is knows Obama reasonably well now, but he's been dealing with this crisis right along, so this is part of the smooth transition in the crisis. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, but, you know, you watched the Sunday news programs yesterday, and everybody from Britt Hume to Juan Williams had to admit that Obama is putting together a first-class team of top-notch people, and he's governing from the center, and people are acting surprised about that, like he was going to be a socialist, you know? That was such claptrap. I can't believe that people were putting it out there, but they were. And, you know, it's this guy is level-headed, and he is going to prove to be a smart cookie, and it's going to drive the right crazy because he's going to make a lot of the right moves. So that will be fun to watch, but what can I tell you? It's a new era in Washington. The Andy Finn Show will be back on WEBR Radio after this.